ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। We are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 4, entitled Amrish Maharaj Offended by Durvasa Muni, Text 21. Evam sada karma kalapam atmana Paredhi Agne Bhagavat Yadokshaje Sarvatma Bhavam Vidadhan Mahim Imam Tanishta Vipra Bihita Shashasaha Eva. Translation. In performing his prescribed duties as king, Maharaj Amrish always offered the results of his royal activities to the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, who is the enjoyer of everything and is beyond the perception of material senses. He certainly took advice from Brahmins who were faithful devotees of the Lord, and thus he ruled the planet Earth without difficulty. Purport. By His Divine Grace, Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 5.29, Bhuktaram Yagyatapasam Sarva Loka Maheshwaram Surudam Sarva Bhutanam Natva Mam Shanti Mrichati. People are very much anxious to live in peace and prosperity in this material world. And here in Bhagavad Gita, the peace formula is given personally by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Everyone should understand that Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the ultimate proprietor of all the planets and is therefore the enjoyer of all activities, political, social, cultural, religious, economic, and so on. The Lord has given perfect advice in Bhagavad Gita, and Amrish Maharaj, as the ideal executive head, ruled the entire world as a Vaishnava, taking advice from Vaishnava Brahmins. The Shastras enjoin that even though a Brahmin may be well versed in the occupational Brahminical duties and may be very learned in Vedic knowledge, he cannot give advice as a Guru until he is a Vaishnava. Satkarma Nipuno Vipro Mantra Tantra Visharada A Vaishnavo Gurur Nasyat Vaishnava Swap Pacho Guru. Therefore, as indicated here by the words Tan Nishta Vipra Bihita, Maharaj Amrish took advice from Brahmins who are pure devotees of the Lord. For ordinary Brahmins who are merely learned scholars or experts in performing ritualistic activities are not competent to give advice. In modern times, there are legislative assemblies whose members are authorized to make laws for the welfare of the state. But according to this description of the kingdom of Maharaj Amrish, the country or the world should be ruled by a chief executive whose advisors are all devotee Brahmins. Such advisors or members of the legislative assembly should not be professional politicians, nor should they be selected by the ignorant public. Rather, they should be appointed by the king. When the king, the executive head of the state, is a devotee, and he follows the instructions of devotee Brahmins in ruling the country, everyone will be peaceful and prosperous. When the king and his advisors are perfect devotees, nothing can be wrong in the state. All the citizens should become devotees of the Lord, and then their good character will automatically follow. Yasyasti bhaktir bhagavatya kinchana sarveir gunais tatra samastate suru Harav apaktasya kuto mahadguna manorathani sati dhavato bahi. On one who has unflinching devotion for the personality of Godhead has all the good qualities of the demigods. But one who is not a devotee of the Lord has only material qualifications that are of little value. This is because he is hovering on the mental plane and is certain to be attracted by the glaring material energy. Bhagavatam 5.18.12. citizens under the guidance of a Krishna conscious king will become devotees, and then there will be no need to enact new laws every day to reform the way of life in the state. If the citizens are trained to become devotees, they will automatically become peaceful and honest, and if they are guided by a devoted king, advised by devotees, the state will not be in the material world but in the spiritual world. All the states of the world should therefore follow the ideal of the rule or administration of Maharaj Ambarish as described here. So, the Srimad Bhagavatam and also the purport by Srila Prabhupada gives us a perfect prescription of how the world can be peaceful and happy, prosperous, what kind of system of government, what kind of consciousness and attitude would be necessary. We see here about Ambarish Maharaj, this one of the most inspiring stories of Srimad Bhagavatam, wherein we will see in the next few verses also his glories, how much he was subjected to suffering and humiliation, but what was his response. Actually, before that, you know, we have to, it's difficult for us, but we have to try to imagine what the situation the situation of an emperor of the world is. It's difficult to imagine because we don't have an emperor of the world. We can't even imagine what it is like that one person is ruling the entire planet. And you can't imagine what kind of a palace this must be. A palace which is for the emperor, where all the provinces and countries and the kings, various other kings, would be subject to the leadership of Ambarish Maharaj. He is the ultimate decision maker of the planet. It's just impossible to imagine that one person can decide, not just for a, even today no country even has that. That would be called a dictator, and there's always tension that he will be shot or he'll be overthrown, and he has to do it by force. This was not by force. This was by sheer respect and love that the people were so happy. So in such a situation, when person is the king of the entire planet, where even the demigods are very respectful to this kind of a personality, in such a situation, to show humility and to actually feel that I'm not the proprietor and that everything belongs to the Lord, it's very difficult to enact, you know, day to day. Perhaps we may say it, but to actually believe in it, that just shows the sheer greatness of this pure devotee Ambarish Maharaj. And actually we see that it is right throughout Bhagavatam, we have so many kings that we come across who are of the same mentality. Lord Ramchandra, because we know, who the Lord came to demonstrate what an ideal king is, but exactly the same principles. Not only there was complete belief in the Lord by the king, but also his advisors, ministers were all of a very high caliber, very sharp in intelligence, but more important, completely devoted to the Lord. So even considering that the king would take consultation in such a situation, when he is the ultimate decision maker, is very difficult to imagine. But that also speaks for his humility, that he would not. He was so concerned about the welfare of his people. As Prabhupada says in the purport, that why everyone was so happy, so blissful, because the king would not do anything which would be against the welfare of the people, and his every moment what was only concerning how can he serve, you know, his citizens. And even the advice given by the Brahmins and the ministers was also in that, in keeping that in mind. Not only that, but they used to also take consultation, or they would keep a tab on what the people thought. It was very important for them to understand what is the mood of the people, and try to, like in Lord Ramchandra's case, we know how a washerman just spoke some completely crazy views, but he was so concerned that even one person may have felt like this, maybe there are some others, that he actually banished Sita to the forest to just set the highest standard. Because in Treta Yuga, standards were vastly superior, of course, without doubt. Even in the beginning of Kali Yuga, the standards were so much higher. So, but we have faith in the words of the scriptures, and therefore we can see through the eyes of the scriptures what kind of a government that was and what kind of a leadership that was. And before we believe, before we think that, well, this is true, but it was in a different era, and therefore it is not, perhaps is not practical today. In the next few minutes that we have, we will see that actually it is the most practical way of doing it. Practical in the sense that it makes even logical sense for people to be, for the leadership to be in touch with what is happening. And you'll see every successful government, or we don't have any, but if you say, even if you take a commercial venture, any successful company, what does it do? It will go out of its way to have so many kind of market surveys and try to see what the customer wants to know. They go to crazy levels, you know, that to see, you know, how many, I mean, they spend tens of millions of dollars on just trying to keep on having the sample surveys to get a idea of what the people want and how the tastes may change, and, you know, what should be the pricing levels. So basically, there also the principle of contacting the people remains. It's only that it is purely for a commercial venture. There is no feeling. There's no desire to for your welfare. It's a desire for your wallet. That is, you know, who can, how you can spend for that product. So that's a different thing. But the point is that they are successful. The ones who do this very, very well, they're the ones who are successful. So even today, if somebody is out of touch with the people whom he is, who are under him, they are bound to suffer. So with this. So the point about establishing contact with the people is very relevant, and we also see it in the story of King Uttanapad. King Uttanapad was the father of Dhruv Maharaj, and Dhruv Maharaj, we all are familiar with the story that he was he became a great personality, then ruled for I think 36,000 years eventually. But our contact with Uttanapad generally is that we know him only when he, in his moment of weakness, when he, you know, he overruled, means he supported the younger wife, and that is Dhruv's stepmother, and humiliated his son. Son fell humiliated, and then he went to the forest, and how he came in contact with Lord Narayan. But actually, King Uttanapad was a really great devotee, just on the lines of Amrish Maharaj. He followed the same principles. And none better, no better demonstration of that than when he eventually, when he was actually still not very old, but when he came to the conclusion that Dhruv Maharaj was ready to take over from him, same, he was the emperor of the entire world, the king of the whole planet, and he took consultation from the Brahmins, he took consultation from his council of ministers. He was also very much in touch with what the people wanted. He knew how Dhruv Maharaj was very popular. And then he had his own judgment. He had his own judgment of evaluation of how his son had progressed. And when all the four were in harmony, then he was confident that Dhruv Maharaj is ready. As soon as he was ready, he immediately left the kingdom, means he left everything to Dhruv, anointed him the king, and left for the forest. Now here's another principle that we have seen, and how what the kind of emperor of the world would be living in, absolutely nothing that he cannot get. The whole world is at his beck and call, and then the moment comes, this is the test really, when voluntarily he appoints his successor, rather than waiting and waiting and waiting till he has to go, or he's senile, or he's lost it, or he's pushed out. Here he is on his own, and then he very happily leaves everything. He doesn't take anything, no soldiers, no clothes, no jewelry, nothing. Just it goes to the forest. And then he has to be eating these roots and berries and so on, and living in the forest, in the caves, for the rest of his life. He's very happy because, why? Because all along he has been so much governed by Krishna within his heart, and he is so much concerned that that every citizen who is also a part of Krishna should be happy, that he has completely understood his role as just being a trustee, or just being someone who's been given a responsibility to discharge it to the best of his capacity. So he fully understood that no matter what the situation or the length of, the strength or the power that he may be having, everything came from the Lord. He was empowered also by the Lord. And he was so much concerned by it that when the time came for him to just externally switch the role of ruler to renunciate, was not difficult, because he was just, the common factor was that he was in touch with Krishna. So this really is a major, is a principle. And the test for him was whether his ruling was for his own personal interests ultimately, or whether it was for the interest of his citizens. And all the kings, including him, passed the test with flying colors. So this is what we know as Raj Rishi. And Prabhupada says that in the purport, that the citizens can be so happy, were so happy, he even says that not only here, but he says in a few other places also, that actually even the present day government, difficult to believe, but even the present day government, if the people are Krishna conscious, then the government will be Krishna conscious. So we may believe that, looking to the few examples we have of kings in this day and age, we think that that is a very outdated position, because generally we see the kings are only having, the royalty around them, and then they have their fun and games, or they may take some, in some countries they may be perhaps also having executive powers, but they do not act and live as a representative of God in the most humble way. They may claim to be God in some cases, but they don't actually live in that with those principles. So therefore it may be difficult to believe, but actually Prabhupada says that even today, if people were, why? Because if people were Krishna conscious, if people are Krishna conscious, then they will choose a leader, they'll vote for a leader who is Krishna conscious. And therefore, the principle is of Krishna consciousness. The principle is not of whether it's a monarchy or whether it's a democracy. Prabhupada would often condemn democracy, we'd call it demon crazy. And why? Because he saw that, with the kind of ignorance and the kind of exploitation that goes around, people will get the leadership that they want. They are the ones who are appointing these leaders. They are the ones who have, because they expect that their own selfish desires will be met. And there is no trace of anything spiritual in that. There's no trace of who's the ultimate proprietor. It is just between you and me. My corporator or my MLA will do this. He'll get me water. He'll get me this. He'll get me that. These promises. Then I will vote for him. He'll get maybe a hospital in my area. So it is primarily related to personal needs. But if the consciousness changes, and therefore Prabhupada's emphasis entirely was to, it was a grassroots level. He started to try to change people's consciousness in such a way that, of course, he was preaching at all levels. The primary motive was to spread to all the places of the world. And he was also preaching to very senior levels of society. But when he started in the US and then spread everywhere, large numbers of people that were coming in all those centers, and even today, it is really to, for anyone who's interested, anyone who tries to hear about the spiritual need of today in today's society, would benefit. So Prabhupada was trying to instill that consciousness of the link with the Lord, so that they, and actually his the revolutionary part of this movement is, as we all are experiencing, is that it's the first time that we've even had an understanding that it is practical. Otherwise we would think that this is something which we would need to recite some shlokas or do something which is only in a compartmentalized place, but it's not possible to integrate in our daily lives. And Prabhupada actually showed that. So which means it is very logical and practical to understand that if just more people were Krishna conscious, and it's a matter of eventually happening, but when more people become Krishna conscious, then even the kind of government they need will be made up of people who have that thinking, who where they will actually put the welfare of the others beyond above their own needs. That kind of selfless activity cannot come unless they see themselves as humble servants of the Lord. And the Bhagavatam says very clearly that Guru Nasasyat, Pita Nasasyat, Swajani Nasasyat, that Lord Rishabhdev in the fifth canto has clearly said that one who cannot deliver his subordinates or his dependents from the cycle of birth and death should not take that responsibility. He should not be a father, should not be a mother, should not be a guru, should not be a demigod, if he cannot discharge his responsibility and take them back to Godhead. So, and what do we find today? That actually the situation is very different. You know, here we are talking about King Uttanapad, who very happily and voluntarily was leaving his palace to go because he had appointed Dhruva Maharaj. We also talked about Lord Ram, who the entire Ayodhya was, they were just dreaming of the day that he becomes king, or at least he's anointed as the, officially anointed as the prince. And when that day came, they were so ecstatic. It is described in so vividly that everybody, you know, that was their heart's greatest desire, that here he's going to, their beloved Ram, whom everybody loved more than anybody else in their family, was going to be their leader. And then overnight he is banished and he is leaving. And Lord Ram had many reasons where he could easily, because he had all the support and even, you know, he could have technically still stayed and, you know, remained, and nobody would have criticized. But he chose to go overnight. So we have one example of Lord Ram who left the palace instantly and went for 14 years. And today we find that MPs, MLAs, who after 15 years after they've left office, they don't vacate their bungalows. Here we are talking of leaving the palace of the world, and here voluntarily, and here, you know, their own houses which have been given to them, but they will not leave. And this is, and even the senior leaders also, I mean, routinely this list comes often, and you find that there are many of them, sometimes after 10 years, 15 years, they have left, but they're still clinging on to. Both at the state as well as at the central level. And now people have got kind of used to it, because if those who are in power will naturally try to control it. And since it runs across all parties, very few people make a big issue about it. So therefore, much of the time it doesn't even come in the news. But whenever it does come, it is just kind of taken as well one of those things. You have also, we talk about the leadership at that time where they were completely detached from their wealth. They were so willing to do everything for the welfare of the people. And here we have people who are today's leadership all over the world. In India, we have the statistic now since 5-6 years, it has become a law that if you stand for elections in the central government, you have to declare your assets. So we do get a glimpse of that. Even that doesn't make big news, but in 2004 elections, the parliamentary elections, statistics were given, and suddenly we found that, people who, put them off profession as social workers and so on, or just their earnings, their wealth is, 5 crores, 10 crores, 15 crores. And 2009, in 5 years later, the next elections came, that was last year, and there are several, out of the 542 MPs, several dozens who are over 100 crores wealth, and many others who are between 0 to 100 crores. So it's a fact that many people have over the years. So this is in contrast to, and I don't think India is unique in that situation. There are this is kind of a trend that people, if they're already rich, then they would like to cling to power. They'd like to have the prestige, in so many ways, the recognition. So the whole attitude is basically what gratifies our senses, what I can get out of it, rather than in complete contrast with the leadership that we saw earlier. And when we talk of leadership, we also talk of the Brahminical leadership. And by Brahmins, we do not mean by birth, but as per the Shastras, one who demonstrates the Brahminical qualities. Also, the ministers were so highly qualified that they were, this was the primary concern, that how could they discharge the responsibility of being the humble servants of the Lord, in within which they had, in their capacity of special functions, they would discharge very well. In the Vedic civilization at that time, to the degree that they were selfless, they were honored. So that was the kind of barometer that were followed. Also, there is a reference in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the second canto. It says that, which is more in connection with the state of consciousness of today, that men who are dogs, hogs, camels and asses will praise those men who do not have any interest in surrendering to the Lord or hearing about any transcendental talk about the Lord. That means they're completely away from the Lord, from Lord Krishna. And I used to think earlier when I heard this quite a few times that this expression is more like how we say that it's raining cats and dogs. So it's more an example that it's raining a lot. It's a phrase. But actually when in preparation for this, I came across this verse and then I was reading the purport, and Prabhupada actually explains that this is the verse in Bhagavatam has been given with great thought, and it is not it's not a phrase, but it actually explains why it has been used. So I wanted to just read the relevant parts. Prabhupada says that the general mass of people, unless they are trained systematically for a higher standard of life and spiritual values, are no better than animals. They are put on the level of dogs, hawks, camels and asses. Now, why dogs? It says modern university education practically prepares one to acquire a doggish mentality with which to accept the service of a greater master. See, dogs are very faithful. They're, after finishing a so-called education, the so-called educated persons move like dogs from door to door with applications for some service. And mostly they're driven away, informed of no vacancy. As dogs are negligible animals and serve the master faithfully for bits of bread, a man serves a master faithfully without sufficient rewards. Then why hogs? Hogs, because persons who have no discrimination in the matter of foodstuff and who eat all sorts of rubbish are compared to hogs. Hogs are very much attached to eating stool. But the human being is not meant for eating everything and anything. He is meant to eat grains, vegetables, fruits, milk, sugar, etc. And why the comparison with camels? The camel is a kind of animal that takes pleasure in eating thorns. A person who wants to enjoy family life or the worldly life of so-called enjoyment is compared to the camel. Materialistic life is full of thorns, and so one should live only by the prescribed method of Vedic regulations just to make the best use of a bad bargain. The central point of attraction for material enjoyment is sex life. To enjoy sex life is to suck one's own blood. The camel also sucks his own blood while chewing thorny twigs. The thorns the camel eats cut the tongue of the camel, and so blood begins to flow within the camel's mouth. The thorns, mixed with fresh blood, create a taste for the foolish camel, and so he enjoys the thorn-eating business with false pleasure. Similarly, the great business magnates, industrialists, who work very hard to earn money by different ways and questionable means, eat the thorny results of these actions mixed with their own blood. And finally, with the comparison of the ass is an animal who is celebrated as the greatest fool, even amongst the animals. The ass works very hard and carries burdens of the maximum weight without making profit for itself. And the special qualification of the ass is that it is very much accustomed to be kicked by the opposite sex. When the ass begs for sexual intercourse, he is kicked by the fair sex, yet he still follows the female for such sexual pleasure. A henpecked man is compared, therefore, to the ass. In this age, the human being is actually engaged in the work of an ass, carrying heavy burdens and driving thela and rickshaws. The so-called advancement of human civilization has engaged the human being in the work of an ass. So Prabhupada concludes that Srimad Bhagavatam's categorization of the common man without any spiritual enlightenment into the society of dogs, hogs, camels and asses is not at all an exaggeration. The leaders of such ignorant masses of people may feel very proud of being adored by such a number of dogs and hogs, but that is not very flattering. The Bhagavatam openly declares that although a person may be a great leader of such dogs and hogs disguised as men, if he has no taste for being enlightened in the science of Krishna, such a leader is also an animal, perhaps a powerful, strong animal or a big animal, but nothing more than an animal. So, it is not meant as a kind of an insult, but it is meant as a fact. You know that, and if you analyze, so we have to see which category we fall in or whether we are out of it. So, what is the result of this kind of mentality? Is that you know, we will then eventually appoint those leaders who would be also of the same thinking, same mentality, and therefore then we cannot blame anyone else ultimately. So we get what we deserve, and it's ultimately a reflection of the citizen's thinking, citizen's mind. So if the world is moving in a certain direction, then certainly their consciousness would be to have that kind of leadership which can give them the benefits, according to the way they see it. And that is why in Srila Prabhupada's case, we know the story of how he came in contact with his Guru Maharaj, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, in 1922. So if you remember, if you link the contact, that as soon as he, the first instruction he got, as soon as he met his Guru Maharaj, and his Guru Maharaj, he just paid obeisances, he had not even spoken a word to him. And as soon as he looked up, and the first thing Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj said, that you are an educated man, you should go to the West and preach. And then Prabhupada tried to argue that time about, the state of the nation, and we are subjugated under the British rule, and therefore we should first establish our independence as a country, otherwise where is our self-respect and so on. And Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj made the prophetic words, which Prabhupada then constantly followed, all the time that Krishna consciousness is the only solution. And Krishna consciousness is constant. Everything else will keep changing. Everything else is temporary. Whether it's one, whether you're under British rule or X rule or Y rule. And we have seen that we've got independence in 1947, but it is not that there has been a greater emphasis towards Vedic civilization or anything. In fact, we have been sucked into the world view of world milieu of going towards more and more materialization, materialistic tendencies. So we have actually changed. In fact, we've gone further away. And today, to the extent that to be known as a person who has some spiritual inclination is considered a kind of negative. I mean, most of us would experience that in our workplace, for instance. People associate that today the importance to make money is so great that if they think that you, never mind if you are an honest person, but if they think that you are too much spiritually inclined, immediately they will feel that this person is not likely to be fit. He doesn't have the ambition, he doesn't have the passion, he doesn't have that, you know, the drive. So this is the state that we have come to. What to speak of people in the highest echelons of leadership? Obviously, they would not want to demonstrate. So there are people, there are leaders who may have some beliefs in the Lord, but they are very careful to camouflage it because they should not be seen in public. For instance, there's one of the famous states in the South where there is a leader. The chief minister is a leader for the last. I mean. They alternate between two of them, but he's been there for the last 40 years or so. And he based his whole movement and his own on so-called what they call rationalism and atheism and supporting the Dravida class. And that is where he got his popularity. But today, though he's in his 80s, and it was recently in the papers that actually it was very embarrassing for many of his party because the whole party was based on rationalism, which when they call rationalism they mean irrationalism, but that means they are actually against. They feel that beliefs in God and rituals and all that are irrational and. They are kind of sentimental or fanatic. So now they find him actually visiting temples. So he used to do it secretly earlier, but now he's so old and senile that he forgets that what he stood for. So he actually goes. So it is quite embarrassing because he's in his 80s and recently undertook a fast. Now we have seen great kings undertaking fasts. We have the example of Rantidev, which I'll just come to in a moment, but who took a fast for 48 days for his own purification. This personality took a fast for 4 hours. And there is a picture where there were two big air coolers behind him. He's on a nice gadi and there's two air coolers and he's sitting there and there's for 4 hours. And that was considered the fast. And it was it was a farce of a fast. Anyway, so these are examples of where we are, but we have to. But Prabhupada's emphasis was, it is not no point criticizing and doing. He had the full picture, and he was the one who could have been the most frustrated by just seeing this. But he went about because he knew that ultimately Krishna is in control, and his task was to help people change their consciousness, and at all levels. And this is what he is expecting of all of us, that we just try to change. If each person tries to change for the better, then collectively there will be, it may not happen in the next month or next year or in perhaps not in our lifetime, but that is not our concern because we never created this world. We have no inkling of how it's happened, but what we will benefit certainly. But collectively, it definitely helps over time. And we do see that there is gradually increasing respect But then there are some obstacles also that come, even within the movement. And because eventually devotees also try to feel that they try to find substitutes for Krishna consciousness. Not that they will deliberately do it, but in the sense that they will... initially, these substitutes could be for thing that it is helping me in Krishna consciousness. And when I talk of substitutes, meaning substitutes for solutions. If you have problems, then you turn to, you know, psychologists or psychiatrists or astrologers or astronomers. And generally, we would say that initially that this is for the purpose of helping my Krishna consciousness. And if it is that's the case, then that is fine. There's no, there won't be any problem. But there are many tests that could indicate to us as to, you know, whether we are putting more faith in the chanting of the holy name, or whether we're putting more faith in any of these valid sciences, material sciences. Whether we are putting more emphasis on the word of, our advisor here, or whether we put, you know, more emphasis on the scriptures. So there would be ways of understanding where we stand with that. But what generally happens very often is that eventually the dependence on these sciences become more and more, and over time it actually it's like the guru becomes the astrologer becomes the guru. He's our we put more faith in what he says rather than what is said by the scriptures. So, but the way Prabhupada was himself demonstrated, because he said that Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, his Guru Maharaj, was actually the greatest astrologer of his time. But then Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj gave it up because he knew that it is a valid science and there are other valid sciences where people will become more dependent. He was not affected, but people will be more dependent. He would be establishing that people will be looking up to him. He could foresee. So he completely gave it up. And Prabhupada would refer often. He would take advice from people. And but then, this is in the words of his servant Abhiram Prabhu, who was with him for the last 7-8 months on this planet. So Prabhupada would consult. If the opinions matched his thoughts about Krishna consciousness, he would accept it. If it didn't, then he would just, as he used the word, he said he would just laugh about it and, you know, toss it. So ultimately, he would not be moved from his vision of Krishna consciousness. That is the key thing. But if we, if our faith is shaken, or then if we are disturbed, then actually it could affect our Krishna consciousness, and gradually, before we know it, you know, it will affect our chanting, it will affect our desire to have association. So people go to counseling groups, you know, which is fine, but they may go for, you know, courses where they taught self-respect and self value or self-worth, the value of me, and in one sense it actually goes against the philosophy. That actually we are trying to say that our ego has to be put down, and here we are saying we have to raise our value. So perhaps in medical cases there may be occasions, but the overall principle is that if that doesn't govern our life and does not overtake our Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada gave this example that you can use this thorn. If you have a thorn in your foot, you can use another thorn to take out the thorn. So this is, in that sense, it fits into that category where you may use many of these sciences where it could help us. We may be able to benefit, or at least we get a general direction if we want to, but. Not that by taking out using another thorn, you end up with two thorns in your foot instead of taking out that one thorn. So we see in the example of Amrish Maharaj, that he was not cut off from the people. We talked about today, the present day need also, that you go to any kind of any successful person, they will always have to, even in corporates or even in leadership. I mean, you can say Singapore was, there is no spiritual base, but if you see from a purely materialist point of view, it has been one of the most efficiently run countries. And one of the main reasons has been that the leadership from the mid-60s to almost late 90s was virtually a dictatorship, benevolent dictatorship, in the sense that it was one man had an autocratic rule, but he was very shrewd enough. He knew that people wanted economic progress, and when they saw that and they got jobs and they got better housing and better this, better material facilities, that they will willingly follow various rules and regulations. So in the limited sense of having control over the people and people trusting him, he managed that because he delivered what they wanted. But here we are talking of, so the principle is the same, but it's on a larger context, and here which is for our eternal benefit, not for a temporary benefit where we may get some gains, but then eventually we get trapped into the cycle even more. In fact, in one sense, in the highest sense, the Krishna consciousness leadership has to provide for being in close touch with, close proximity with the people, even in the temples. If we say that I am the doer, or I am controlling this, or I am it is my risk, because of me that this I took this decision, which we all find very often outside in the outside world. If this creeps in into the temple, at any temple or any spiritual organization, then gradually it can destroy the fabric of that spiritual sustenance. And it is my observation that people, it's very, very difficult to give credit to others, especially in the outside world, very difficult. What to speak of giving credit to the Lord? There are, because what we, when we see that somebody who has had a tremendous success from the beginning, from humble beginning, and he becomes, say, a billionaire, there are so many things that happen. There are circumstances which fit in very well. So, a person has gone to the, what we see externally is a person has gone to this university, he studied well, or maybe he was a dropout, but he was very creative, he did this, he probably set up this venture in his garage, and then he, but who gave him the thought to implement it in the right time? Who gave him that kind of environment when, just like Prabhupada always said that Krishna arranged that environment, that when he went to the West, everyone was ready to hear, because there was a cultural revolution going on. So actually there is nothing like a luck, everything is organized by the Lord. So even in the case of material success, if somebody whose karma is such that he is destined for a tremendous material success, so he has been given that creativity, he has been given that energy levels and the enthusiasm. But if we misutilize that, and it's particularly if we ignore where it comes from, then we will be suffering the consequences for a long, long time afterwards, for many, many lifetimes, in fact. So, Radhanath Maharaj was explaining some time ago about, when we say about being cut off from people, and he said that we've in the ivory tower, there's a phrase called don't be in your ivory tower, which means that don't be out of touch with reality. And he explained, that is the first time I heard that there is actually an ivory tower in the Oxford University in England, where scientists from various people all over the world, the scholars and researchers, they actually come there, not necessarily scientists, but scholars and researchers who come there, and they want to dedicate entirely for their particular for their field. So they are closeted there and they shut themselves out completely so that they can focus only on their field of research. And for that, they create that exclusivity and that situation where there's no disturbance. But then they are completely shut out from what's happening outside. So therefore this, when we say that we are in, if you are in the ivory tower, it means that you are actually completely cut off from reality. And this is where we see much of leadership, both mostly in the outside world, but sometimes also even in spiritual organizations. For instance, if the spiritual, in the temple, if there is no time for devotees, or if you put projects before people, that means you are concentrating on, you know, because there are people who will come to the temple, they are happy to give donations and so on, but if you are just concentrating more on building projects and assets and not and neglecting the needs of devotees or new people who are coming in, then these are the kind, similar traits that you are actually also in a dangerous zone. There's also the example which of the in the French Revolution, this Queen Marie Antoinette, who which is a very famous one, many of us have probably you've also learnt in school, that she was completely so cut off from reality that when the people were starving in her country in France, and when they came and said, and when her ministers came and told that that you know people need bread, there's no bread. She said, well then give them cakes. So eventually they didn't want cakes, so they wanted a head. So she was actually beheaded. So that was how much she was completely cut off from reality. And this was only a couple of hundred years ago. And against all this, we see the example of Lord Ram, where he used to actually send spies into the people's homes, just to find out what they want and how they're feeling, what are their problems. Sometimes he would also go in disguise and he would try to go and try to personally understand what their worries were, what the difficulties were. Imagine what is the level he was in, and this was his primary concern. And that is where the reciprocation always comes. And actually, that is the truth, that when we reciprocate, if we think of others, it's a matter of time before you know the relationship improves, and they are also bound to you know come much closer. King Prataprudra is another example, which is nearer our time, just 500 years ago. A great leader, a great king, and he was also in he was sweeping the streets of Jagannath Puri. But it was not, it was ecstatic for him to do it. But that was not the only thing. He was also making a statement to the people that this, I'm not only me, all of us are humble servants of the Lord, and that eventually that is our constitutional position. And if the king, who is very much revered and respected, if he himself were to put that statement or make that statement by his action, by his own personal example, then people very happily and willingly would follow. King Uttanapad, we discussed how appointing Dhruva Maharaj, how he took careful consultation, he took his own judgment. And Rantidev was King Rantidev, who's actually, the story comes also in the 9th canto. It's a very electrifying, a very inspiring story of another great king who, exactly in the same mood of Amrish Maharaj and Lord Ram and King Parikshit and others, was purely concerned with the welfare of the people. He would die for the for his citizens. So once he was actually fasting for 48 days. Actually, his family also was fasting with him. And this fast was also not for, it was only for the purification, for his purification, so that he could rule the citizens better and he could please the citizens or better. So it was more for his internal purification. It was not for any other reason. So when he his fast was about to end at the end of 48 days, and by that time he and his family were on the verge of death. So then fortunately the time got over, and then they arranged for the food and prasad and water, and then they sat and they were just about to eat the prasad. At that time only a Brahmin came there. And the Brahmin said, oh King, I'm extremely hungry, I've not eaten anything, so please give me some food. So immediately, without any thought, King Dantidev gave him as much food as he wanted and fed him to satisfaction. And then when the Brahmin went, then he sat down. And just when he was sitting down, that time Shudra came. He was about to take the morsel, and the Shudra came at the door and said, that, "Oh King, I have not eaten for many days, and please give me something to eat." Now he divided up the food between his family and fed the Shudra as much as he wanted. Shudra also ate and left, and then there was very little left for him. And then he sat down to eat that prasad, and he was just about to eat. At that time, a man came with a pack of dogs, and saying that, "Oh King, my dogs are very hungry." And without even a moment's hesitation, he gave the whatever was left, was little that was for him, he gave it to the dogs. And by now he was trembling. He was actually on the verge of death. And the only thing that could have sustained him was the water. And he was about to take that water when Chandala comes at the door. And Chandala is the lowest of the social outcasts, actually. Then he comes and asks that, "O King, I am very thirsty. I have not had. Please give me some water." And at that time, King Rantidev, he was ecstatic. It is said that he was in complete ecstasy, and he immediately prayed to the Lord, saying that, "You know, I do not want the 8 mystic siddhis. I do not want liberation. I only want to serve, to be with the people who are suffering so much, and if I can take their suffering." He also said that, "I am now about to die. I don't think I'll be able to live, but I'm by giving this water to the Chandala, I am actually free from my hunger, from my thirst, from my fear, from my lamentation." And he was extremely happy to do to the service. And then, of course, the Chandala and the dogs and the Brahmin and the Shudra and all, they came. Actually, they were Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, all of demigods only had come to test him. So they came to him in their original form. And their motive was only to demonstrate the glories of this great king, so that glories would live on and we would be benefited from it. But he was he passed the test with flying colors, because he was willing to live by that, by the principles. And Srila Prabhupada formed ISKCON for many purposes. We have the 7 purposes, which are officially the objectives of ISKCON. But one of the principal purposes was that he wanted to create these type of leaders. These leaders who will be in the future assets to the world. And he didn't mean only somebody who rises to a post of a temple president or a GBC or a sannyasi or not that. He wanted each and every one of us to be leaders. When we hear the story of King of Kolavicha Sridhar, Kolavicha Sridhar, we know the story in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's time, when he was a poor, very, very poor banana leaf seller. And he was so poverty-stricken that, you know, he had even his home, this thatched hut, had holes in it, and there's absolutely no money. But he was actually also a great leader. As Radhanath Swami once said, that his example is so inspiring that even 500 years after he has left, we are still talking about it and admiring it and worshipping this kind of personality. So eventually, our concept of leadership is that we see people, we think that leadership associated with power, with lot of people to rule over, or a lot of assets to manage, or somebody in a visible position. So we are seeing only from
narrow point of view. But eventually what Prabhupada said, when he said leadership is basically just somebody who is willing to take this mission seriously and actually set an example. Because what the world needs is example. How many examples would there be of this? And when one sets an example like this of, say, Kolavacha Sridhar, he was a different type of leader. Pratap Rudra was a different type of leader. Both were in the same era. One was a king, one was very poor. But both were leaders. Just like in a different context, when we say that Arjun was a great warrior and he won, and he was a great devotee. And Jatayu was a great warrior, he was a king of the vultures, and he lost. But can we say he lost? I mean, both were pure devotees. Both gave their lives for the Lord. So it is not the external manifestation whether one is rich or poor, one is really got, you know, ruling the country, or whether one is just on the streets. But it is the internal character that can inspire, and then that is the leadership that all of us are expected by Srila Prabhupada to demonstrate and to gradually inculcate, such that we can be worthy of him, and that we can actually give try to repay our gratitude to Srila Prabhupada for what he has given us, for giving us his knowledge, eternal knowledge, and for no desire of our own, that we've got this opportunity to follow this movement, and slowly, slowly we can perfect our lives. So I'll end here. If there are any questions or comments. Mataji, any...
Hare Krishna, it was a most beautiful lecture. Prabhu, you are a grihasthi and you are also in business. My question is that when we preach our family, other people, the times have so bad, as you said, everybody is trying to make money, power or whatever. Aren't we trying to do the same? We are pushing our children to get 90 plus marks, and it is so difficult, children are bewildered, they don't know what to do. Why we are pushing them? What to do? Where they will get jobs? Unless they are 98 also, they are frustrated.
Well, when we are part of, when you are born in this world, in this era, definitely there are more challenges now than maybe 100 years ago or 50 years ago. But then, if we were born 100 years ago, we wouldn't even have had the Krishna consciousness understanding which Srila Prabhupada has given. So, everything is in his own perfection. Krishna has put us at the time when we actually came in contact. So now we are here in this age, in the 21st century, and as you said, that the needs are so strong. So, but it's a matter of, first of all, what is our internal belief and convictions? And then we have to also be practical and live by the external rules. For instance, we follow the rules. When we cross the road, we don't just cross if it's red. We have to wait. Right? So these are the rules that are for everyone, and we are citizens. So, yeah, but so it's one thing to passionately and at the cost of causing stress to the children, pushing them, that is bad. That is definitely bad. And even non-Krishna conscious, non-devotee circles also will say the same thing. But therefore, our endeavor would be to see that we see what a child is capable of. Some children are very academically oriented and do very well. Some people have well, but they may not go to that level. So instead of creating that kind of highly stressful situation, which would be very harmful for the children, that we should definitely avoid. But at the same time, whatever they're capable of, we encourage them, and actually giving them a lot of love and encouragement, and in general, creating a very loving atmosphere, and having the child have a very strong belief that my parents or my family members who are staying with me really, really love me, then whenever we have to make any, say, corrections, or when in such times, no child likes to open the book and study. If you just leave it to them, most of them would just want to play. That's the nature of the child. But they have to also learn discipline. When we tell children that even if you don't like, see, there'll be in future many times when you'll have to do things which you don't like. So take it as that. Don't take it as if you are getting some taste out of it. This may be to, say, 12, 13, 14 year olds, you know, who may not feel like. So you can encourage them lovingly and go up to a level, but not such a level that we are satisfying our egos. Many times when the parents are causing stress, is because they want to demonstrate, you know, to people outside that my child is the brightest, you know, my child is doing very well. So it is actually an extension of their ego. So this would destroy the child. This should be avoided. So you need not cause unnecessary stress. But this world and this time is such that no matter where you are born, there is stress anyway. So all we can do is minimize the stress. And eventually when the person matures and comes to a certain age and takes up to Krishna consciousness, that is the solution for stress. That is the solution for everything. So in preparation for that, if along with the studies, if the child is exposed to spiritual life, the child is exposed to deity worship, these are natural things which come to them. Just naturally, they love, they're exposed to kindness, compassion, say they understand other living entities, and they love, children love animals. So, you know, when they see, they see that there's no discrimination. These are values which come with the parents if they're Krishna conscious. Then, you know, the child is getting an all-round preparation in which the subject of study is whether he doesn't like geography or doesn't like maths and he has to do it. But instead of whipping him, you know, coax him to do what he can. And, you know, ultimately, you know, if he or she has other inclinations, then support him in that way, or support her in that way. But they'll actually blossom to the extent that they can, and we have to certainly put gentle pressure, but in the loving environment which is created, which is most crucial. That is absolutely the most critical need, which sometimes is missing. Because if that is created, then, you know, the child, you know, children are children. They may not like to do this, not like to do that, but eventually if they don't have the slightest doubt that there is genuine, and that love doesn't mean giving everything to the child. Love means that there is concern and attention for every, you know, when the child needs the parents, and when they're there, the parents sacrifice for the child, and the child sees that. So if that atmosphere is there, then the aspect of studies becomes secondary.
But yeah, Prabhu, nobody gives admission unless you are 85 plus, and unless you are graduate, you are kicked out of the society. So what to do?
So ultimately, when 2 lakh students or 3 lakh students appeared for SSC, you still have, I don't remember the exact number, but probably 20-30% who don't pass. Then there are many who get 50%, 60%, 70%, right? So we may wish what we want. We would definitely also make an effort within the way I explained. But eventually, say if the child is not academically bright, so what are we going to do about it? So you know, but then if we are tortured in our minds thinking that I am a nobody, I am a complete waste in society, my child is also shamed me, my child is embarrassed me, etc., then we are only showing what is value to us. For us, the value is other people's opinion. For us, the value is that admission only. We don't. So it's like one of those things that things may not happen the way we want, but we accept it. Somebody may want good health. Health may not be good. Somebody may want, something goes wrong in the office. He loses his job. He goes to another job. So eventually, you have to accept a situation life. So if the child just cannot go up to beyond a certain level, if that's the case, then. But if the child is made to feel that you are no good louse, you are you're absolutely a parasite to society because you couldn't go to his college, is that what our values would be? Is that what is going to make him Krishna conscious? That should be a major concern. And within that, we make every effort and see if the child has it in him, we do it. Here we have so many examples of 150, 200 devotees who are very, most of them have actually got double graduates and so bright, and they've voluntarily given up what we want to achieve, and they're actually living in a cramped up place, renouncing everything you know, pursuing and very blissfully, very happily. So if we learn from this, then we will also change our internal values and understand that we have to do what we have to do, but this is not where our heart belongs, and this is not where our happiness and distress barometer also moves. We have to check that first. Is that what is going to cause us happiness and distress? We have to do, but then eventually this will be one of those things. Even if you have someone who's 98% and gets into good college and all that, well, fine. You know, the child is able to do that. But you will have other issues, other problems are there. So we have to face all kinds of problems. So this is one of those things which is not the governing principle of our, of our happiness. So I'm not saying we should not make effort, but we should make effort in the loving environment and also with great care and consideration for the child, because the children cannot take stress and should not be subject to stress. And anyway, they're stressed, there are things which are not in our control. When they go to school and all, there will always be an environment where they have to study, tests are there, etc. But we should not cause unnecessary stress. We can balance it by, you know, having the happy periods with the children where they are also very happy, and, you know, where you give yourself. The parents should give themselves to the children.
Thank you.
Any other questions? One, you pass the mic here.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. I would like to ask that sometimes the situation comes, like in the war of Mahabharata, Bhishma Dev and Arjun, both were the great devotees, and they have had to fight each other for their own sake of dharma or for their own sake of perception. Similar is the situation like Ambarish Maharaj and Maharshi Dirvasa. So if such situation comes in our lives, what we have to do? We have to take the miseries on ourselves, or we have to finish the other side?
You mean whether we should... See, in the case of Arjun and Bhishma Dev, Bhishma Dev is a Mahajan, so we understand the role he played, and he actually is one of the greatest devotees of the Lord, but he had to play the role. Everything was done under the auspices of the will of the Lord. Lord Krishna was present there anyway. So in our case, when a situation comes, first of all, we won't be Ambarish Maharaj. So that you can rest assured. Maybe I'm presumptuous, but I'm not sure whether you also will be, and I certainly won't be. And I don't think we'll have that. But if you're saying that somebody comes to stop us from Krishna consciousness, then we have to certainly protect our Krishna consciousness. I think that's what the bottom line is, that if there are people who are... we have to be doing in a mature way. For instance, if that opposition is coming from the family, so we have to take consultation and guidance how to do it. Some people are not understanding what we are doing, or maybe not appreciating, but they're not obstructing, then we should be understanding also, because till some time ago we also didn't know anything about this, so we should not be reactive and fighting and so on. But if someone is actually physically obstructing, there are maybe a few cases where their bead bags have been taken away and then they're forced to eat what they don't want to eat, what is against our principles, then there's a certain response, but that also can be taken with guidance. But in most cases, we want that other people should appreciate what we are doing. That may not come. And people will have their own views, and especially older people, older age, it's difficult for them to change. So we shouldn't, but we should take advice before we do. We should not be reactive.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Hare Krishna. One small announcement from Radha Gopinath Media Services. Last Sunday, we had the opportunity to hear from His Holiness Indradumna Swami Maharaj. Wonderful lecture with an amazing and heart-touching story. So the audio and video with high quality is now available with Media Services. Those who have missed it or wanted to hear it again can take your copy from the media stall downstairs.